This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Hello, and welcome to My Tale to Tell, bringing you life stories from the varied and diverse people who live in Canterbury, New Zealand. All of these stories are read by those who wrote them as part of a Writing Your Memoir workshop, and they have kindly agreed to share them with you. For privacy reasons, some of the names have been changed. Some language may offend, and some content may shock you. But no life is ordinary. We all have a tale to tell.
My tale to tell, my scariest moment. It is hard to remember what is the most scary moment in my life, other than experiencing the Christchurch earthquakes, but that is another story for another time. The story I will tell today is one that happened around 1962 in India, where my parents were working at the time, and I was just a schoolboy. The place was in the Nilgiri Hills in South India, where my school was located. The Nilgiri Hills rise up to 7,500 feet from the plains of India. The climate is very much like that of, say, Auckland here in New Zealand. Being so close to the equator, it never got really cold, but enjoys an even temperate climate and has attracted local tourists for well over 100 years, especially during the very hot summer months of May and June. When the British ruled India, all the senior civil servants and officials came up here, and many built elaborate holiday homes, many of which still exist and still used today. The hills are covered in forest, but much has given way to massive and extensive tea plantations, as well as planted eucalyptus forests that are harvested for their oil. All this makes for a lovely place to live and a great location for schools. The downside is that it is 1,100 kilometres away from home where my parents were working, so it was quite a trek for them in their old 1939 Wolseley car to visit me every May holidays. It was a good 3 days' drive on the poor quality Indian roads of those days, and inevitably the car would break down somewhere, often where there was little help at hand. Well, this year was no exception. And this time it was the fuel pump. The fuel pump, for those interested, was an SU electric unit, and it isn't hard to imagine that it was nigh impossible in those days to buy a replacement. No popping down to the local Repco or super cheap auto to get a new one. Dad was not a very mechanically minded person, but along with the help of a local mechanic got it going again, sort of. Well, they eventually arrived at school to pick me up, and off we went through the hills to another town about 30 kilometres away. The drive was up and down and around the hills, and you guessed it, the fuel pump stopped working again. Although still just a school kid, I always had an interest in cars and anything mechanical, and got to play with this pump to see if I could do anything to get it going. It must have been my Kiwi number 8 wire jeans that kicked in, as I found that by tapping the pump I could encourage it to work, but only for a minute or two. This was obviously not a permanent solution, but it got us going for a while. I had to find a better solution, and I did. This old car's bonnet, unlike modern cars where the bonnet usually lifts from the front, had hinges down the center and along the top edges, so access to the engine was from the sides. The solution to our problem meant that I sat on the left mudguard with my feet down in the engine bay, with my left hand holding onto the radiator, while tapping the fuel pump with my right hand. In theory, this would be fine, so off we went. Dad, bless him, was a good old rugby-mad cow-cocky Kiwi bloke that didn't hang about when he was driving. Now, the road had, in the distant past, been tar-sealed, so it wasn't too bad. But it was very narrow, and Indian drivers, by and large, aren't the best, and screamed round corners with little worry about other drivers. So here we were, rattling along, steep drops off the side with no safety barriers, oncoming traffic, hills and sharp corners every few metres, and me hanging on for dear life, madly tapping this recalcitrant fuel pump. I was never so scared in all my life. Thinking about it, I guess Dad's idea was to get to the next town as quickly as possible, but he was oblivious to his only child hanging on for dear life. Definitely something I would never wish to repeat, and it still makes me shudder at the memory of that ride on the mudguard of Dad's old 1939 Wolseley.
My name is Louise, and this is my scariest moment. My scariest moment is about spiders. Spiders used to terrify me when I was a child. My mother's family had two holiday baches right on the waterfront in Kaiteri. The land and baches had been gifted to the daughters of my mother's family by my grandfather's mother. They were unfortunately sold by my grandma in the 80s, but that's another story. As a child, we would spend every summer at Kaiteri Terry when it was still pretty low-key. When my mother's family had bought the land, Kaiteri was really for the hardy folk. My mother's family had owned the water rights to Kaiteri Terry, so had been instrumental in the setup of the structure of how Kaiteri Terry worked. In the 1970s, I remember the road from Christchurch to Nelson in Kaiteri had patches of shingle road. The road was always being worked on. I can remember being eternally carsick on the Hope Saddle or the Shenandoah, and my dad driving with his fingers pressed to the window screen in case a rogue stone might smash it. There was always dust flying around on the unsealed roads. Nowadays, these roads are unrecognisable. They are smooth and all the dangerous curves have been taken out. The batch we stayed in was basic. The toilet was a long drop outside. And I would sleep in an area that faced out to the beachfront that had a curtain that pulled closed at night to make it into a bedroom. Where I slept was the sunniest room beside the dining area. I would wake up in the mornings, waking to the gentle roll of the calm morning sea coming in and out over the sand. I would get up, I'd sit on the edge of the kitchen table and watch the water come in and out and scratch my sandfly bites. Mum and Dad were still asleep in a dark and scary room with old beds and old bed coverings. I have a picture of me in a bikini as a 12-month-old sitting on the beach at Kaiteri Terry playing with the sand. But each night, I would see a spider, a big, fat, hand-sized spider, and to this day I can still see it. I was terrified, crying and whimpering. I was really scared. I remember my dad coming to soothe me. There was no spider, he would say, but to this day I can still see this large, huge, hand-sized spider that was on the top corner of the wall on the other side to my bed. Even now it doesn't feel like it was made up. I'm sure that it wasn't real, but it was really there on the wall when I was six. It wasn't until I lived in Sydney in my 20s that I overcame my fear of spiders. The huntsman was my making. I had to sort these buggers out when they would climb up and rest on the curtains in my bedroom. I learned to judge which way they might jump, as they do jump rather than speedily run away, and I'd get them out of my bedroom with one swoop of the broom. From here on, spiders. Pah, what spider? That's not a spider, I would have find myself thinking when a spider the size of a 50-cent piece would scoot by. The Australian huntsman became the mark of what a spider really was. And now in my family, I'm the one who gets rid of the spiders, capturing and killing the white tails, putting outside the daddy long legs nestling in the corner of one of the children's bedrooms, while everybody else quivers in fear. The conversation goes something like, "You should go live in Australia. You will stop being scared of spiders in New Zealand. Really, the spiders are more terrified of you than you are of them. They won't hurt you." My scariest moment of spiders on a wall in Kaiteri Terry is perhaps relative to my age. I was only six, and I think I had been scared of spiders for a while. But in my mind, this one was the mother of all spiders, as each night it would come skulking into the bedroom walls of my makeshift bedroom, terrifying the living daylights out of me.
They say that these are not the best of times, they're the only times I've ever known. I believe there is a time for meditation in cathedrals of our own. Now I have seen that sad surrender in my lover's eyes.
I'm Isabel, and this is my tale to tell. A scary moment. Southmead Cottage was built in 1889 in Newtown Road, a road intruding into farmland a few miles from the nearest town, Uxbridge, in Middlesex, in the UK. This was where I and my young sister were born, where my dad was born, and my great-grandmother spent her last days. My dad, born in 1909, could remember, as a four-year-old, kissing his granny goodbye as she lay in her coffin in the front room. My sister and I still have a curious attachment to the cottage, as if it was still ours. It was sold after our dad moved to a serviced accommodation in his late 70s to live nearer my sister, Thelma. On my fourth birthday, I remember seeing Thelma soon after she was born in our parents' bedroom upstairs. The cottage was cold and damp, even in summer. Many years later, Robert and I visited Dad in the cottage, and Robert was curious that the wallpaper was more brightly coloured halfway up the wall. That was rising damp. We had a coal range in our living room, which was our source of heat. Mum cooked on it, heated water for our baths, aired our clothes before we got dressed, and we sat around to keep warm in the evenings. We always kept the door that led to the upstairs closed to keep the warmth in. This door also opened up to the hallway entrance and the front door. The stairs faced the front door and went up to a landing before a few steps led to the floor above, which had a bedroom on either side. I was born in the left-hand bedroom, and Thelma and I shared the right-hand bedroom. There was a cupboard under the stairs for storage, but it was empty except for gas masks. The reason was, we were supposed to get under the stairs when the warning air raid siren sounded. We never did. We dived under the kitchen table in the living room, or, if it ever went at night, under the bed. Although the house next door was bombed, we never had occasion to wear the gas masks, thank goodness. Thelma and my mask looked like Mickey Mouse's head. I couldn't stand the smell of rubber. I couldn't breathe. At the beginning of the war, my cousin John told me that their family lived with us for a while, and he can remember that I was put in a crib that acted like a gas mask. It was probably made of rubber. Most of my memories are after the war, and Thelma's also. Both of us in later life admitted that we got spooked about the landing on the stairs. Neither of us would climb the stairs on our own at night. Thelma said she used to see a shadowy small lady in white on the landing disappear up the stairs. I also saw a shadow disappear, nothing that I could define. However, it was a scary moment. And after that, the landing seemed spooky. Fortunately, the bedrooms were okay. I did wish that we had a lock on the door. Sometimes in the evenings, when we were sitting in the living room and all was quiet, we would hear someone moving on the stairs. We'd ask Mum what it was, and she would dismiss it as nothing. "It's just the wind," she'd say. I left for New Zealand when I was 19, so didn't see the cottage until years later. One time when I was visiting, Sally, Thelma's youngest daughter, and baby granddaughter Yasemin, Thelma and I took a drive to the cottage. We were surprised at the changes. The tiny front garden was now concrete, just big enough to fit a small car. And the original water supply to the cottage, a bricked lined well, was buried underneath. A builder had bought the cottage and completely modernised it. When I knocked at the door and said I was from New Zealand and was born here, the owner, Bruce, invited me in and showed me round. Thelma and Sally, who wouldn't come with me at first, later their curiosity got the better of them and they joined us. My ever-romantic sister and our genealogist said, "Do you know how many generations have been in this cottage?" And then she listed them off. Great-grandmother Mary Campbell Lennox, grandmother Louise Judge, and granddad John Mayling, dad John Mayling, mum Elizabeth Cuthbertson, Isabel and me Thelma, Sally and Yasemin. Bruce said he loved living in the cottage. Of course, you know it's haunted. To our amazed reaction, he said, "Oh, don't worry, she's quite a harmless old lady and doesn't often make much noise." I like having someone in the cottage. No scary moments for Bruce then.
My name is Julie, and this is my tale to tell. Scariest moment. Well, this was scary, but it didn't really start as a scary tale, more of a happy tale. It begins. As I was self-employed, I was in a wonderful position to be involved with Kashmir Primary School. The teacher of Amelia's class was responsible for having parents come in to support students who needed reading recovery. Every week, we would go along for an hour to assist where we were needed. This particular day, I was being a kind parent with a little boy who was having reading practice in my daughter's classroom. My daughter was oblivious to what I was doing. We were sitting in the reading corner, and this little boy had finished reading his book with only a little bit of guidance. He looked up at me and said, "What is that on your face?" Somewhat surprised at the question, but immediately knowing what he referred to, I replied, "It was a beauty spot." Thinking that would stop any further comment. Oh no, he hadn't finished yet, saying, "No, it's not, it's a wart." Well, that had me thinking. I should do something about it. I really was not excited by the knowledge that particular child and possibly other children as well thought I had a wart on my face. Being a marriage celebrant added to my desire to see it removed. The next scheduled visit to the doctor, I explained I was a celebrant and I thought my beauty spot should go. My lovely female doctor, who had training in removing moles and things, looked at the mole and said, "It looks okay, but we need a plastic surgeon to do it." The question was, did I know any surgeons? It really wasn't the circle I had moved in, so I replied with a resigned no. So she proceeded to write down the names of two working in the same practice. I got home and rang for an appointment. The female surgeon was away on holiday, so I got the earliest appointment I could with Chris Porter, the other surgeon. We had an appointment and he said, "Yes, looks okay, but we'll do surgery and remove it. We will do it here." So I was laid back, and when I was comfortable and the nurse and the surgeon were ready, we removed it. A nice, neat job. You could tell he was a great surgeon. They said they always send moles to the lab, and I went home happy, showing off the neat job on my face. A few days later, I got a phone call from Chris. He did say he was going to call to see how I was, so I was not at all surprised to get the promised phone call. So when he said good news and bad news, I discovered the good news merged with the bad news. Good news, you're coming to see me today. Bad news, it was a melanoma and we will need to remove it. My heart sank and I felt an overwhelming sense of disbelief. How could everyone have thought my beauty spot, mole or wart, depending on who was talking, have believed it was harmless? I got off the phone and David, my husband, asked me what was wrong. I said it was a melanoma and I have to go to see Chris today. I was thinking, oh my goodness, this is not good. This is scary. And I burst into tears. David said not to worry. It should be okay. I wasn't in the space to appreciate his reassurance. I knew that New Zealand had one of the highest incident rates in the world for melanoma. Melanoma is a type of skin cancer. At the appointment, Chris, without ceremony, proceeded to tell me we're going to do what they called a flap reconstruction in hospital. It was to be a 3-day stay. We will take 2 centimetres of tissue in all directions around where the mole was, and then we'll pull the skin from your neck and stitch it neatly into place. It flashed through my mind. Not at all bad, a nip and tuck. We were looking at the schedule, and he said, next week, to which I responded, I have 6 weddings to perform. Can we do it the following week? And he said, yes, but the sooner the better. There had only been one couple who I had to phone and say, look, I'm sorry, I'm having surgery and can't do your wedding ceremony. I had already found a replacement for them, and they were so good about it. I take it very seriously when I accept a booking and hate letting people down. For 2 weeks, I worried about the surgery. Will they get enough tissue to ensure it is all well? I knew full well that melanoma are the silent killers. I relate it to a bit like an iceberg. What you see on the surface is only very small with what you see under the surface. I remember being wheeled down for surgery, knowing that they'd remove first a mole on my back of my leg, one on my shoulder, and then do the flap reconstruction. I woke up in recovery, and there's plenty of bandages in place around my swollen face. After a few days, I was home and in recovery mode, knowing that they'd put some special tape over the facial scar so the 12 days after surgery, I'd be able to do the wedding with makeup on. It was impressive, and because it is in my smile line, hardly noticeable. It is only when I tell people and actually show them the scar they realise I have had a flap reconstruction. Every 3 months, lymph node checks. Once a year, a visit to a dermatologist. On my first visit to Dr. Nichols, the dermatologist, one of only a couple in town, he said that it was a nasty mole. I was extremely lucky they got it all, my lucky escape. And I'm delighted to say that all happened well over 5 years ago now. All cancer sufferers see the first 5 years as the golden window when you're praying, hoping, and truly delighted when you stay well. I have seen many celebration announcements of the 5-year success on social media. It really is a big thing. I check my moles regularly against a little mole checking chart I was given. I will always be thankful to that little boy for being the instigator of my desire to get the mole removed. That is my scary tale that turned out well in the end, and it was really my great escape.
Tell is produced by me, Stephanie Fruin, and engineered by Peter Rattray at Plains FM Christchurch. The theme tune was composed by Louise Ayling and performed by Louise Ayling, Peter Royal, and Stephanie Fruin. If you'd like to take part in My Tale to Tell, contact mytaletotellnz@gmail.com. No life is ordinary. We all have a tale to tell.
Memories of us.